Thank you very much, Alex, and good morning, everybody. Very nice to see you. Many familiar faces, and I hope that we have a happy time together. Health reform is such a depressing topic that I thought I'd better find an alternative venue for next year's CEDA conference. And the little vignette on the top right-hand corner is actually a place called CEDA in the Dolomites. So if CEDA and the Commonwealth Bank and other sponsors would care to consider holding the conference there next year, I'm sure you'll find many takers, and the atmosphere may be a little happier. Ladies and gentlemen, everything has changed, especially when we're thinking about financial sustainability of anything, including health systems. And I think that we really do need to contextualise our comments about financial sustainability in the light of these massive international changes. It's a matter of record that during times of affluence we can have conversations about sophisticated healthcare systems, but for those people, the 1.2 billion of them who live on a dollar a day, and that number will increase, these conversations are irrelevant. And health and economic well-being are so tightly interlocked that we need to remember that changing in the economic environment will have a major impact on our deliberations about health. Our national prosperity will help redefine the financial sustainability debate about health. The form of my presentation: what do we want our health system actually to do? The scan of trends in current expenditure, the drivers of those, the current reform agenda, the things we need to do, and the contribution of prevention, what we should and should not expect of it. Those are the things that I want to speak about. Ed Pellegrino was a very interesting renal physician who wrote eloquently and spoke powerfully about medical ethics. He did a poll of taxi drivers in Washington, D.C. to ask them what they wanted from their healthcare system. The first thing they wanted was that if they had a serious threat to life that was treatable, it would be treated and their life would be saved. Hemorrhage, pneumonia, meningitis, obstetric problems. Second, when they discovered a problem, a lump in the throat or a skin lesion, they wanted someone to transfer the anxiety for the management of that problem as soon as possible. Not next week or a year later, but now, like now. Phone up and get help. And the third thing that they wanted was relief from pain and good palliative care and support and comfort if nothing indeed could be done. Thomas Faunce, who's a medical ethicist in Australia, has said that the central defining characteristic of the medical and other caring professions is that they have a compassionate concern about relief of suffering of the individual. Faunce actually puts prevention to one side and says, yes, it's important, but it's not the fundamental job of the caring professions or indeed of the health system. It's an interesting and controversial perspective, but one that reminds us, as he says, what it is that motivates the healthcare workforce and what makes doctors and nurses and others late for dinner. Maintaining health is something that I think most of us would want from the system. And by that I mean not only an attention to the environment, but for those people who have an impairment, making sure that the residual health is maintained as well. Sometimes we overlook the fact that health and health services are about caring, and that the social glue, if you will, that holds society together as a nice, pleasant, democratic place in which to live requires that those values are reinforced. It troubles me frequently that people think that healthcare provided through Medicare is free, Whereas in actual fact, they are the people making a contribution that keeps it going. And yet that seems to get lost sight of, and so the moral value that comes from contributing to caring for other people gets lost on the average taxpayer. We speak about healthcare costing a percentage of the GDP. Wrong. It accounts for a percentage of the GDP. Frankly, if you wanted to increase productivity and lead a spending spree in relation to infrastructure, why not go to Queensland Health? You could spend a lot of money there, Andrew. You could build a lot of infrastructure. You could generate a lot more economic activity. So I just think that we somehow have a view of health expenditure at times that sees it as a ghastly cost, as though the money sort of shipped all offshore, that does nothing to stimulate the economy. This is one of the biggest employers. So if you're really serious post Greenspan in stimulating productivity through investment in infrastructure, I commend the health system to you. We need to maintain the commitment of professionals. It ain't easy. Why not? Look at the complexity of that graph that David showed you. People get demoralised who are busily working at the bottom of that hierarchy, especially when people want to micromanage every moment and every thought that could be construed as innovative. If you get a bright idea, the clinicians at Westmead Hospital, where I used to work, tell me, don't bother, because it'll have to be ratified by 10 committees, and one of them, any one of them, has the power of veto. This is not the way to encourage and maintain morale. And research, which David Pennington and others have written eloquently about, as a critical element in the maintenance and development of our health services. If you cramp that, if you don't allow people to try things and make mistakes and learn from them, the thing just becomes solidified. And we want, of course, a health system that won't bankrupt the economy, thanks very much. The comparison of citizens' views about the health system, I draw your attention to one uniform trend, and that is in all of the countries, a decline in the number who are enthusiastic about rebuilding the health system completely. In Australia, the figure dropped from 30% in 1998 to 2007. Perhaps it's because of the complexity that people are loath now to contemplate a major rebuild, or perhaps fundamentally they understand its complexity, or that their satisfaction with things is better. However, in Australia, we still find that over 50% of the population surveyed through the Commonwealth Fund from New York believes that some kind of change is needed. Interesting that the relatively uniform figures across those five countries. Late last year, some of my colleagues and I wrote a paper for the Medical Journal of Australia identifying what we believed were matters of considerable concern that perhaps the new government could consider. They are fairly obvious things: changing demography, recent advances in medical technology, workforce supply, which Andrew has spoken about very persuasively, persistent concerns about the quality and safety of health services, which we seem to tinker with around the edges but never quite get onto completely, the question of balancing public and private, the need to invest more in the health of our children, the role of urban planning, especially when we contemplate prevention of the major chronic disorders that derive in no small part from the way in which we plan our cities, run our transport, supply our food. And that an understanding that achieving equity in health, especially for Indigenous Australians, is going to take us outside the health portfolio. Education, commerce, big business. The increase in costs, of course, is a concern. and the effect of an ageing population, which together with lots of technology that can do lots of wonderful things for them, creates what Gary Banks from the Productivity Commission has called the ageing technology toxic cocktail. A little reassurance to you that, as Gary put in his oration in Canberra earlier this year, that the drivers of past health spending, a point that David showed too, have remained relatively stable. And don't be beguiled by this graph, because on the vertical axis is the annual growth rate in real terms of each of those. So just about everything's going up. If you're looking to curtail those costs, then it's improbable that you'll be able to affect population growth. You certainly can't influence age profile. GDP growth may suffer some significant changes, as we know. And the technology and residuals are perhaps the ones where some form of financial censorship might be exercised, but as Kenneth Galbraith would have put it, there's a technological imperative operating there which is extremely powerful. Health costs, as we know, rise steeply with age, whether you're looking at hospitals, pharmaceuticals or medical benefits across the interval from about 45 on. And that is part of the background reality that we need to account for when we contemplate sustainability. The current reform agenda has been referred to both by David and by Andrew, and some of those agencies are listed in that frame. I suppose I find myself wondering whether incrementalism is the only choice. Probably. But when you reflect on some of the major and dramatic disjunctional reforms of the past, whether they be Medicare or the introduction of the pharmaceutical benefits scheme, just wonder whether there's not something around the corner that might be equally dramatic. National health reform, there are two major agencies, the Health and Hospitals Reform Commission, which has as the elephant in the room the Commonwealth-state relations. And that is a huge struggle. Gary Banks has estimated that a more efficient, and this is the beauty of working with the Productivity Commission, enables you to make statements like this, that there are probably several billion dollars that can be saved by a more efficient relationship between the Commonwealth and the states. Rob Moody, known to many of you in Victoria, has the job of driving this huge low loader with earth-moving equipment, chairing the Preventive Services Task Force. This is heavy lifting. This is where not much has been going on and where new program development will occur. And that's a huge responsibility. Speaking about prevention, let me take you back. Some of you may remember the age of the iron lung and polio, which was defeated through the biomedical efforts of Salk and Sabin. They're on opposite sides of the graph here because they're on the opposite sides of just about everything and hated one another's guts. Salk was the jab and Sabin the oral vaccine. But between them, they have got rid of these huge wards where people were nursed in cuirass ventilators. Every one of those rocket segments has got a human individual in it who can't breathe. That's why they're there. And although our instant response to this might be to say, "Whoa, isn't that good? Look what we've been able to, look at the costs we've been able to cut." Just remind you that inside those ventilators is a human being, each one of them. And the primary purpose of prevention always, always, is the improvement of the human condition, not saving money. Sorry to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, but that is it. And any misconstruction of prevention damages the historical perspective that we gain from people like this. There's a big interest currently in prevention. Number one, why are politicians interested in prevention? I tell you why, because people are interested in getting interested in prevention. They are fed up with the obesity and the diabetes epidemics, and they're wanting things to be done. This is Michelangelo's portrayal of David. You might have seen it in Florence. That's what happened to him when he went on a loan tour to the Met in New York. Obesity is not a genetic disease. It is an environmental disease. It's not created by a group movement whereby people every morning wake up and say, today I think I'll grow a little more obese. What can I do to achieve that goal? It's absolutely environmentally conditioned. And not to see that and to fiddle around the edges with strategies that don't confront it, I think, is really political obfuscation. Anthrax, terror and bird flu have provoked our interest in prevention quite dramatically. Look at that poor postal worker driving around Washington in a space suit when the anthrax scare occurred in 2001. The woman carrying a Big Mac and a can of Coke is just to remind you this is a global problem. Everywhere, in every country, chronic disease has taken off in a big way as fast food, cheap, high-calorie foods and the outlawing of the foot as a mode of transport have occurred in our cities. Important to remember that prevention has several types. Think a moment about Indigenous health. No one, I think, these days says, oh, just a little medical fix will fix it. We realise that it has to have a broad-scale attention to the environment. Victoria's done well with road traffic safety through primary prevention, advertisements, breath testing, working with groups of liquor outlets and others to really shape a new social environment in which drinking and driving have decreased. And indeed, the death rates from road traffic accidents of people loaded with alcohol have gone down. Secondary prevention is an area where we take population like this and through your general practitioner urge you to have things like your blood pressure and cholesterol checked and if necessary have that treated through lifestyle change or through pharmaceuticals. This is a huge area of preventive activity that we would overlook to our peril. It is confluent with good medical care. It accounts for at least 50% of the downturn in heart disease death rates in Australia since 1996. Andrew's done some very excellent work showing the relative contribution of this. Very important area if we're considering prevention and sustainability of the system. And tertiary prevention seeks to reduce problems in those people who've already got an established health problem. That huge population of people who have an established chronic disease problem, emphysema, heart disease, musculoskeletal problems, other things of that sort. Whether this field is secondary and tertiary prevention are really well recognised in the preventive agenda in Australia is something that my colleague Leslie Russell has been assessing, looking at the budget papers, and I have to say to you that one wonders about the seriousness with which mental health is being taken in this country when the last budget cut $272 million out of the mental health budget for the next 4 years. That's not a budgetary move that is consonant with notions of secondary and tertiary prevention, let me say. It may be consonant with something else, but not with that. So there are three forms of prevention. There's no one simple, single form of prevention. It's not just all about eating more fruit and vegetables or jogging more and enjoying it less. It's about environmental change, it's about good medical care for people with risks, and it's about good care for people who have an established health problem. Obesity is a big ticket item and on the way up. As you can see for both men and women, the gap between 1995 and 2005. The things we need to do. Health literacy means the understanding of ordinary people about what health is and what the system is and how to use it. In our research work recently in Western Sydney, interviewing people with chronic problems, one word comes out for me of all of those, and that is bewilderment. They're bewildered by their illness. They're bewildered by the medical treatment. They're bewildered by the system. They're bewildered by the where they're going. As one man said to me, "Tell me how I'm going to die. I don't know. No one's told me." We have, and into this population where people are bewildered and ignorant, we say, "Oh, I'd just like you to do a bit of preventive behaviour." Well, I mean, hello. We need a much, much more literate population. If you go to my university and say, where can an enlightened undergraduate take a course in health? Well, they're hard pressed to find it. They have to wait till they're a graduate and then they can do public health. But I'd put to you that if we are to build on the dissatisfaction of the community as it is at the moment with this obesity business and pressure to eat more food that's not good for you and exercise less, that we need to work with the community to improve their levels of literate understanding of health. Not easy. Schools, elsewhere. We recently conducted a telephone survey with NAUS and the Menzies Centre, about 1,600 Australians, and asked them a lot of questions about health. And one of them was, in the last year or so, has a doctor provided advice or counselling on any of the following issues? The responses varied a bit. I'm happy to say that those who had health problems got more advice, but a lot did not. Yes or no, for weight, majority got no advice. Smoking, no. Diet, no. Exercise, no. So we have a gap here to fill as well. If we take it that the medical profession and other primary carers have a major role in prevention, we need to get them on side in providing useful information and counselling to patients. Now, here's an interesting one. We ask people two questions. Do you think it'd be a good idea if private health insurance premiums were adjusted so that if you're a smoker or you're overweight or you're over 65, it's fairly ominous, personally, should you be paying more? And on the left-hand side, you can see when we asked them should people who smoke pay more or should people who are over 60 pay more, the majority said no. But just to show you that inconsistency is alive and well, we asked them also, do you think that if you don't smoke or you're younger or any of those that you do not manifest any of those risk factors, you should pay less? And the majority said yes. Now, I'm being a little cruel. It's not necessarily inconsistent. I think it actually reveals quite an interesting difference in attitude. And that is that in the community they say, please don't get into this punitive stuff. Be supportive. And if you can quit smoking or lose weight or go to a gym and get fit and the rest of it, there should be some reward in it. And I think that is a very securing understanding of the nature of prevention, that people are keen to see it happen. They're keen to see people supported in their preventive moves. What can we expect from prevention? Well, the three different forms of prevention that I mentioned have very different yields and they cost a lot more. But when you aggregate all of prevention and all of clinical care, it's striking that the cost per year of life that you win is more or less the same. Prevention can be a cost saver. Obviously it can. If you keep people with chronic problems out of hospital, you're saving cost on terms of caring for that individual. But the system is so complex in David's model that it will quickly close over the gap and fill it with someone else with another problem. So we need to be very cautious about prevention as a cost saver. It can add to sustainability, can be a very important part of cost-effective reallocation of resources, which is, again, as David said, may be one of the fundamental questions we're facing, not how much more can we spend, but how can we better spend what we've got. Prevention has a major contribution to make that in that. And it's principally about keeping people well or health stable. It's absolutely in line with the purposes of those taxi drivers in Washington had in mind in Pellegrino's thinking, and Faunce's central ethic of the caring professions. It sits clearly, closely and constructively with all of those. A sustainable system is going to need multiple reforms. We've heard a lot about those today. State, Commonwealth and public-private are critically important questions. Health literacy is central to health sustainability, and prevention is a way of thinking, and I sustain it. I endorse it to you as a way in which we can achieve a sustainable future for Australia's healthcare system. Thank you very much.